Here we're just about to commence. Burial is doing good today. Again, we just do a brief audio check before we start the class. And we'll just start the class in a few minutes. Make sure that everybody could confirm that you have the audio. Okay, we'll start the class momentarily. We're going to continue with the Maimonides' principles, the fundamentals of the Torah. And again, once you hear the audio, just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen. That'll confirm for us that you can hear the audio. And you may have to increase your volume just a bit, depending on the connection that you have. And again, once you hear the audio, just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen and we'll get started. And we'll be referring to Maimonides' Mishneh Torah. And we're right at the beginning. We just started this section yesterday regarding the proof that God exists. And understanding this in terms of conviction, not just blind faith. The Torah system requires that we use the intelligence, God-given intelligence, for the reason, the most primary of all concepts, and that's God's existence. Okay, looks like a lot of you have the audio going already. And again, if you hear the audio, just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen if you haven't done so already. And we'll just start just momentarily. Just wait for everybody else to confirm that the audio is functioning properly. And again, if you miss any part of the class, we usually do them Sundays, Mondays, and Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. United States Eastern Time. If you miss any part of the classes are recorded and they are archived on our website right here underneath the audio files link. And again, once you hear the audio, please make sure your speakers are turned up and just type audio okay at the bottom of the screen. That'll confirm that everybody's picking up the audio properly. Okay, so let's start the class. Looks like everybody has the audio working. Okay, so let's just review what we were discussing yesterday. Maimonides was discussing the concept that two statements he opens up with. And okay, so the statements that he made is that Yesod HaYesodos V'Amud HaChachmos, the fundamental of all fundamentals and the pillar of all wisdom, is to know, not believe, but to know that there is a first cause. There is a primary existence. And that he caused everything that we find in existence. He alone. And everything which we find in the heavens and on the earth and anything in between are not in existence except because of the truth of God's existence. And when it means the truth of God's existence, the reason why everything exists because of the truth of God's existence means to say that it's because God is the one that has essential existence. We made a very important distinction, and the distinction was that everything that exists was brought into creation. So by definition, it did not need to exist. It was only through God's will that everything that we see in the universe and on earth and in the heavens and everything in between, it is only because of God's will that everything exists. Had he not had this will, then nothing would exist. So nothing has essential existence except for God. God exists without there being a need for his existence. That's something which we really can't fathom how that works, but then again, like we mentioned yesterday, even Moses, who was the highest prophet, the greatest prophet, and he asked to know God's true nature, God responded that man cannot know me while he's alive. So it is impossible in our current state that we should be able to grasp all truths. Okay. And let's just, again, I just want to confirm that everybody has audio, so let's just do one more audio check. This would apply to everybody, just to type audio okay 2 at the bottom of your screen. Okay, that'll show that we have the audio is being is flowing out consistently. It's streaming out consistently. So if everybody could just type in the bottom of your screen, audio okay 2, that'll just confirm just one more time that audio is going through fine. Okay, so now we understand that there's a distinction between the existence of everything in the universe and the existence of God. The existence of everything in the universe is dependent, whereas God's existence is independent, and that's his nature. Our nature is not to exist, otherwise we would have always existed. So anything whose nature is to exist, and that would only apply to God, so it always exists. How that happens, we don't know. Okay. And just a quick thanks for those of you who are helping out everybody else in terms of directions on the audio. We appreciate it. Okay, so that was number one idea. We also observe that Maimonides says that you must know that God exists. This is not something which is just allowed to be left to a blind faith or belief like other religions. We have an intellect for a reason. God gave us the ability to prove things, and that should be applied in the most important of areas, and that is the realization that God exists. That's really our objective. One of the 613 commands, if not the most primary command, is to love God. That means to say that a person has to have knowledge, proof that God exists, and not just blind faith. And we explain numerous times that the whole basis of the proof for us today that God exists is the story of Sinai, where there were over 2 million Jews that witnessed an event where a mountain was completely on fire and they heard an intelligent voice emanating from the fire. And we explained also the reason why God created the event in that fashion with fire and a mountain and a voice is because what he wanted to have was a proof for all generations. God, we say that it's not God's will they should always be doing miracles. He gave us intelligence because that's the way to arrive at greater and greater knowledge. And the way God created the event was that there was intelligence that was speaking from fire. And we said fire is the one element on Earth in which no biological organism can exist. I mean, if there was a cloud on the mountain, or if there was water, or if the mountain was engulfed with water, or earth, or any other element aside from fire, then a person would not be forced to say that this being that's speaking right now is supernatural. You could say it's a biological being, because there's nothing which opposes life in water, or earth, or cloud, or air. Fire is the one thing which opposes all life, all intelligence. Therefore, God created an event in which there would be a proof for all future generations that what those Jews heard at Mount Sinai was not of this world. They heard intelligence speaking from a fiery mountain. And the reason why it was a mountain was because since there's so many people, so therefore they needed to have an elevated platform. In this manner, people at the end, at the outskirts, at the peripheral of the whole camp of the Jews would still be able to witness the event. In terms of like current day stages, we have just the opposite. The stage is below, and like in arenas or coliseums, and then all the seats go higher and higher. So this way, no one in front of another person obstructs the view. Now, the fact that that story traveled through history as a truth, it's impossible that we would have had that story today, that we would have that story today, that the world unanimously accepts it, and even other religions. The only way that we have that is that it was really passed down as a truth. It wasn't passed down as a fairy tale, and we also have the number of people at the event, the tribes, the names of the people are enumerated in the Torah on a few occasions. This way, there's no room for doubt who was there, what year it was, how many people were there. All right, and we'll pause intermittently in terms of taking questions and comments, because the way we work the class is to pose questions, and then you have to think about it. At that time, I'll ask you to put entries on the screen. For right now, I'll be looking into the Mishnah Torah, so I'm not going to really be looking on screen. So if you have questions, hold off. If you already typed them in, we'll retype them again when I ask you to shortly. Okay. So now we understand the basic proof that we have today that God exists. And that is the fact that we have this story that was unanimously accepted and passed through all generations, and the story's content is undeniable, and it is miraculous in nature. And it could not have been orchestrated by a human. Any human would die inside fire. And the mountain was burning with fire, it says openly in the text. In contrast to other religions, that you may, we talked about this yesterday too, a person may say, well, look at the other religions. They have millions and millions, tens of millions of more followers than Judaism. So does that prove that other religions are true? No, the answer is no. And there's a very simple distinction you have to make. Other religions are based on faith. They ask you to believe something, that some event happened, and if you take a look at the Gospels and the New Testament, that the Christianity and the Protestants and the Catholics have, you'll see that none of the events that they purport to be true miracles have masses at the event. They don't have masses at the event, so you either believe them or you don't believe them. The reason why so many adherents follow these other religions is because of the appeal, the emotional appeal. You know, Jesus can die for your sins is a very appealing thing. So no wonder it's spread like wildfire in the matter of years. And that's why there are so many adherents today. And the religious emotion is a very strong emotion, but if it's misdirected, it can be attached to something which is false. Hitler also got an entire society, an entire country, to believe that they were an Aryan race. Does that mean it's true? Is there proof to that? No. But in terms of getting masses to believe something, that can exist. But in terms of getting masses to be convinced that they saw something, that you won't have. And the words of the Torah are clear. Moses says to the people, don't forget what your eyes saw. Now, how could he tell this to the Jewish people, and they would pass it down as truth, excuse me, if their eyes didn't see anything? The only way that they passed down this story to their children until we have it today, over 3,300 years later, is because they must have been convinced of what they saw. And when Moses reminded them, don't forget, when he was writing the Torah and he gave it to them, he included those verses, that lest you forget what your eyes saw, the day that God had the assembly at Sinai, and the mountain burned with fire, and the voice of words you heard from the fire. And all you heard was a voice, but you saw no form. Moses makes it very clear that you didn't see any form. All you saw was fire, but the form to the voice you didn't see. Therefore, he reiterates, he underlines the concept that there was nothing physical about this intelligence that was imparting knowledge, imparting a system of laws to mankind. And again, this was the one time in all of history that God did a mass revelation. And you'll check all your history books, you'll check all the religions. Again, what you have to have is proof. You have to have solid conviction of this reality. That's the fundamental of Judaism. That's exactly what Maimonides is saying here. And without having that conviction, so everything else is going to fall by the wayside. So it is of the utmost importance that everybody has the concept clear in their mind that God does exist. It's proven. That story is the proof that we have today, that account. It's just like we are convinced that Caesar was the emperor of Rome. The fact that he was an emperor in a certain location, in a certain era, is something which is very simple phenomena. Nobody has any question about whether a person is knowledgeable of the year that they live in, or of who a person is, or what country they reside in. These are all very simple pieces of information. So we don't assume that there's any type of ignorance. Because the only way that a story in history that we would have today would be questionable as true is either one, we say that the story that's passed down to us is lies, so it's fabricated. In that case, you would have to show that there was a motive for so many people to lie, and that's impossible. A motive is a subjective feeling. A person has his own subjective framework as to when he's going to lie about something. So you're not going to get, for example, if you go to a baseball stadium and you try to convince 60,000 attendees that the team that lost really won, you'll not be successful because you're not going to have numbers like that with a common motive. Once you have numerous attendees at an event, that removes any possibility that there's a common motive and that they're all going to lie about something. You can have a few people conspire to something. That's basically how the other religions started. And you see how long it took to start in terms of Jesus. 70 years, 40 years, 150 years. And there's so many accounts of what happened. You have four gospels that conflict. There's four different accounts as to what took place. That itself shows you that it was not accurate. It was not real. So if we could show that any event in history had numbers of people, we remove the possibility that the story we have today is fabricated, because numbers of people will not have a common motive. But maybe all the people, you might say, were ignorant of what they saw. That's why the story is very clear that what they saw was very simple. Everybody knows what a mountain is, everybody knows what fire is, and everybody knows what intelligent words are. So there's no possibility of there being ignorance present at the event at Sinai either. Now, once you remove those two possibilities, either a purposeful, misconstrued story or an ignorant, misconstrued story, if you remove those two possibilities and you show it can't be a purposeful lie and it's not an accidental miscommunication, then there's no other possibility. It must be true. Okay. If you have that idea, let's just type an OK on screen. It's important that I get some feedback from you. Type an OK on the screen. This way I'll see that the idea is clear. If there's any questions at this point, now you can type them in. All right, it's very important that you have this idea clear, that it's impossible that the story we have from Sinai today is a fallacy. Impossible. It's like if you say Sinai is a fallacy, then you would have to say that Caesar is a fallacy. And every other piece of history we have today, you would have to say it's all untrue. But if you are clear on the fact that any story that you have communicated by masses, and the story itself was attested by masses, that's number one. And number two, The events recorded are easily apprehended by any normal person. If those two ingredients are in any story, then you must admit that the story is true. That is the proof for all history. And Joseph is asking, why do some people believe that there is no God? Well, you have to ask them. The proof is that there is a God. Judah in, I guess that's Michigan, is asking, we have 2 million signed depositions. No, you don't have signed depositions. What you have is better than that. You have people that are communicating the story. That's the deposition. He's writing further, look, I believe in the real existence of God, and further, that this God is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But this being passed on as a proof is not worthy. This is faith. Why is that difficult? Joel's question from before. Okay, well, you show me how this is something which is fallible. Where is the fallibility in terms of our conviction in history? How do we prove anything in history is true? It's proven true by showing that it's impossible to be false. Once you show that there's no way this story can be false, it had to be true. But separate any emotions you might have about disbelief because it's miracles or things that are like that. I mean, I'll ask you, Judah, do you have any question about Caesar being the emperor of Rome? Do you have any question about Alexander the Great being the great conqueror, that he lived in a certain time? All right, think about that. If you don't, then you see that the reason why you might have a problem with this story is because there's certain miracles involved. But if the story did not take place, let me give you a scenario. Okay, we used a scenario yesterday. Here's a scenario. I'm on the George Washington Bridge rush hour. Let's say there's about 200,000 people, 100,000 people. And traffic stops, and a spaceship comes down and gives me some tablets with some writing on it. Now I go to the news, and I go to people, and I tell them that I was on the bridge at this time of the day. It was 5 p.m. The bridge was packed, and the spaceship came down, and there were 200,000 people that saw this as well. Now, if I'm the only one that's going around telling this to people, which is what you're going to have to say, Judah, because it really didn't take place, so we do have the story today. Our eyes tell us the story exists. So that means somebody wrote this story and started going around and giving it to people. Now, if I would start writing a story about what happened to me on the George Washington Bridge today about this spaceship, a supernatural phenomena, and I start telling everybody, and I tell them also that you were there, and don't forget what your eyes saw, I would be locked up in a matter of seconds. There'd be no way that I would be able to convince even one person that he saw something that he didn't. Moses would have had the same exact problem. He can't go around to a nation of 2.5 million people, and the numbers are recorded. There are 600,000 men above 20. Then you add the men below 20 and all the women. You arrive at about a number of 2 million people. So if I cannot be successful today, it would be the same thing with Moses. But the only way that people would accept that my story is true is if I can produce the other 200,000 witnesses, and they corroborate exactly what I'm saying. But the fact is, the event didn't take place today at 5 o'clock, not because it's not 5 yet, but because it's not going to happen. And even after 5 o'clock, and I go around and tell this to people, and I could make the most beautiful-looking stones with the most cohesive writing on it and claim this is an alien substance, nobody will accept it as true. There are no masses to prove the story. And on top of that, if I'm going to go around and tell people that you saw it yourself, forget it. They will resolve that I'm some sort of a lunatic. Okay. All right. Let's see if there's anything else at this point. Who else has questions? Naomi is asking, is it true there were 600,000 men and probably a total of 2 million people at Sinai? Yes. Okay. That's accurate, and you'll see that's in the story itself. That is in the Torah itself. And Davide in San Francisco is asking, is the Sinai event of proof a single event? I guess you're asking, is it proving a single event? Yes, it is proving that event. Okay. All right, Naomi. Joel's writing, I have no problems with miracles. I have no problem with faith. I have reasonable problems with textual criticism. Okay, well, if you have an accurate critique On text, fine. But you have a unanimous story. Why should this story be any different than any other historical account? Okay, Patrick in the Netherlands. They received the Ten Commands. They also received the Torah. They also received the written Torah and also the oral Torah. So it wasn't just the Ten Commands. The rabbis have a dispute on that point as to what it's referring to in the Torah. But today, unanimously, the rabbis agree that God gave the written Torah to Moses. And my understanding is that the written Torah up to that point in history, and then as history unfolded, either Moses wrote it down section by section, teaching the Jews as he got the received the word from God as to actually how to write it down exactly, or he wrote it down at certain increments. But in terms of all the information from Genesis up to that point, which was the Parsha of Jethro, so that was certainly received, as well as all the oral law, the Mishnah, and everything which we see that the Talmud elaborates on. Okay, Rabbi is saying, as far as I know, there is no alternative version of this event, which is evidence that it is not made up. That is also a good point. There's no alternative story. If there was a real history that took place and it wasn't Sinai, so where is that story? It would be impossible to say that the real account vanished and this one displaced it. Joel is suggesting rules of evidence are divided. First-hand experience, the testimony of persons who are deposed, and trustworthy things that are self-evident. We have one record of Moses who claims 2 million witnesses. I believe this, but we are relying on the account of one man. No, you're not, Joel. You're relying on those people who transmitted it. He tells them in the book itself, don't forget what your eyes saw. They would not pass that down to us today if they didn't see anything. I cannot get anybody today to believe this event that I just fabricated about the aliens on the George Washington Bridge, or even God on the George Washington Bridge, if I can't produce other people. And if I go to them and I say that you saw this yourself and don't forget it, they will not pass it down as truth. Everybody will have a reputation of me as being a lunatic, somebody who's psychotic. That is what will be passed down. Davide, now that is the one proof. Sinai is the one proof. That's all you need. Once you have an absolute proof, that's all that's necessary. The story itself, you'll see, it actually says, Kol Gadol V'lo Yosaf. It was a great voice at that event that never continued. And some of the rabbis explained that to me, that God will not do it again. One reason is because it's sufficient. Once you have an absolute proof, that is all you need. Additionally, God does not want people to be coerced in terms of following Torah. He wants people to use their minds. That's precisely why he created a proof. God knew that future generations would want to know for sure that this event took place. Therefore, it's something which is provable, but you must use your intelligence to prove it. And it doesn't matter that it's secondhand knowledge. Okay? Naomi's asking, and we were all there. No. Even though there is a medrash that says that all future souls were at Sinai, that's not literal. You have to understand that when the rabbis wrote, they wrote in riddles. They wrote that way because they wanted to explain, as one of my rabbis taught me, the reason why the rabbis in the Talmud and even the prophets, like King Solomon in his book of Proverbs, he says right in the beginning, I think it's Proverbs 1:6, he says one of the reasons why he wrote Proverbs is in order that we could understand the riddles of the rabbis. And the reason why the rabbis wrote in riddles is in order to put into a concise format lots of information, because to elaborate on all the points would be very lengthy. So in order to just hint to those points, they give you a riddle. Then it's up to you to use your reasoning and to unravel them. Okay. So that's what it means, Naomi. We were not all there. But what it means is that just as if we were there, meaning just as if we had firsthand knowledge, we can have absolute proof of God's existence as if we were there. So when the rabbis write that all the souls of future generations were there, first of all, they didn't write that without finding some allusion or something to rely on in the words. Because it says that this was given to the people that were there and who aren't there. So that means to say that the Torah's obligation was given to that generation of Jews and for all future generations. And on the words, and also to the Jews that were not there, quote unquote, the rabbis want to use that to say that, and they made a riddle. They said a metaphor. They said all the souls were there. But it doesn't mean that's true. Who today remembers being at Sinai? If you don't remember it, what use is it? What it means is that just as the people who witnessed the event with their own eyes physically know 100% that God exists, so also all future generations have the same proof, as if our souls were there. Okay. Joseph is asking, did the oral law exist in the Garden of Eden other than Yeshua? No, the oral law was first given at Sinai. Okay. Al in New York is saying this might be a side point, but I was asked or told that the Torah must have been given before. When there are certain allusions, certain metaphors, again, that the rabbis write that Abraham kept Passover. It doesn't mean that he kept Passover because there was no Egypt yet. There was no Exodus. You can't celebrate an event that did not take place yet. What it meant to say, and this I'm quoting another rabbi, Rabbi Reuben Mann, he mentioned that Abraham had the perfections that the Passover holiday gives to us. And that needs study. So what perfections is that pointing to? But again, the rabbis write in a metaphorical language, and you have to understand that. Again, King Solomon said that openly, and Maimonides' son tells you openly that you can't take these things literal. There's a story about this person named Og that lifted up Mount Sinai, and there was a whole story about it. Is it possible for a human being to lift up a mountain? No. So it must mean something else. But these riddles are very enjoyable ways to think into what they're talking about. And maybe we'll take that up in the class. We'll do some. Okay. Jewish notions of reincarnation. Sadia Gaon says there's no such concept of reincarnation. And we actually have some articles on the website, so feel free to take that up. In terms of reincarnation, Moses tells the people that you have one life. He says, choose life or choose death. That means that a person will have a certain fatality if he chooses the wrong thing. No second chances. That's why it's so important to try to not waste time and to use our lives the best that we can. Ben Noach is asking, there had to be an oral law in Gan Eden. God commanded everything to Adam by speech, not writing. No, he only had one command, Ben Noach. There was only one command to Adam. Robbie is saying, if the event was not true, when could it have been made up? It would have had to have been made. Would have to have been before King David, because he proposed building a temple to house the Aron HaKodesh. Someone would have questioned this. Right. Okay. I'm not sure your reasoning. Let me just move on. Okay, Naomi, you're welcome. Zadie is writing, but all Jewish fetuses know the Torah and forget it when born. Please explain. Okay. You know, Zadie, why don't you just jot that down? Let's take it at the end of the class, because I don't want to get too far off the topic. All right? I know that these are very intriguing. This one, actually, I can answer you very quickly. I mean, Plato even talks about this idea, too. And he says that when a person learns something, he's really not new in the way we understand it. It means the mind has certain categories. And when you work at new ideas, what you're really doing is it's more of an act of recalling certain basic concepts that are really part of the human soul. Like, for example, a person doesn't have to know, a person does not have to be taught the idea of equal. When, for example, a baby will recognize the face of somebody as not his parent and he'll start crying. Why? Because the mind automatically compares. It tries to make an equation. It uses the principles of equality. See, in order to recognize. Recognition is done by seeing something and then instantaneously recalling in a person's memory if this is their mother or not. There are visual cues, there are sensory cues, in terms of smell, they say babies recognize their parent that way. So you see that the concept of equal, of equality, is not something you have to learn. It's something which you're born with. You automatically start doing it. So when you use equality in certain thoughts, that's what they mean, that you're recalling, you are using things which are already part of you, meaning given to you from the womb. So the rabbis say that when you're born, an angel touches you on the lip and you forget everything, meaning to say that you knew everything in the womb. But just in terms of plain facts. That's ridiculous. A baby knows nothing in the womb. And second of all, like we said, since the rabbis speak in riddles, we have to unravel what they mean here. So what does it mean that the angel touches the baby on the lip and it forgets? It means to say that at birth, there is at birth all of the main categories of knowledge, like equality and many others. By just using equality as an example of things that you don't have to be taught. Okay, but let's save the other peripheral questions for afterwards. In terms of thanks, have to tell a person not to take literally, then he will say that I shouldn't take other things literal. Okay, good question. We'll get to it. Let's get back to Maimonides, though. Yes, Noah did hear God's voice. Those were commands to Noah, not for all people. So it's not a Torah that Noah got. Okay, let's hold off on the entries because I'm going to look back in the text and I don't want to miss anything that you're going to write. So at a certain point, I'll ask again and then you'll write down. Okay, so we now understand that this event at Sinai had to have taken place. It's impossible that it would reach us today if it didn't. That should be clear. That's very important. Because with conviction that God exists, then he's a reality in our lives. And then we want to learn further. And we also understand the idea that God's existence is not dependent on anything else. Right? God does not require anything to give him existence. The best we can put it is that his existence is essential to his nature. It's not something added. For example, our existence is added. It's something which is not necessary. That's why we didn't always exist. It's only by God's will that we came into existence at a certain point. But that does not apply to God. And he's careful, Maimonides is careful to state clearly that everything in the heavens, on earth, and everything in between, and that encompasses every single bit of physical creation, these were all brought into existence by God. Okay, and we also said yesterday the importance of why the Torah commences with Genesis. See, the Torah is not a history book. The Torah is starting with Genesis, with Bereshis, the fact that God did an act of creation, because before you go further and study what this God is telling you to do and what is good for your life, you first have to understand how do I identify what this God is in as far as human terms as possible. So our best definition is the one that created. So right at the outset of the Torah, God puts in the information that he created the heavens and the earth. This way, it's not just telling us this is how time started. It's true. I mean, time itself was a creation, according to Maimonides. But in terms of why Genesis starts with the Big Bang, is because God wants, it's necessary that we have the correct concept before we go further. The correct concept of God must be the one that is inextricably bound up with the fact that he is the creator of everything. And similarly, we said that our prayers in the morning, when we finally get to the first series of blessings in the morning, the first blessing we say is, blessed is the one who spoke and the world came into existence. Again, each morning we have to reiterate this idea that God is identified as the creator, and there's no other. Okay. So now we understand why Maimonides says that you must know, because we have the ability to know. We have the ability to have absolute conviction, and that he is the first. Right? That's important that we know that he is not dependent on his existence for anything else. His existence is based on his own nature, which itself is just an amazing idea. Okay. Let's just want to review a few more points, and then we also had a question that we left with yesterday. Just give me one sec. Okay, and we also said a very interesting distinction. Maimonides opens up, his very first words are that this knowledge of God is the fundamental of all fundamentals and the pillar for all wisdom. So we asked the question, knowing that Maimonides is very exact in his language, we asked the question, what is the difference between a fundamental of fundamentals, meaning that this knowledge of God is the fundamental underlying all other fundamentals, and also it is the pillar of all wisdom. What is the difference between fundamentals and wisdom? So what we explained is that after creation, we have something called wisdom. We have sciences. Prior to creation, that event, that era, if we could use the term, we're just using it loosely, but prior to creation, even without the world, God's perfection does not lack anything. And after he created the universe, again, his perfection doesn't gain anything. So anything which is absolutely true about God is not dependent on creation. That's a very important concept. You must realize that there are two points in history. One is before creation and one is afterwards. In terms of before creation, the Talmud says that we can't try to think into what took place. Our minds just can't. Our minds work with cause and effect, and that's limited to the physical world and physical senses. All the knowledge we gain is through the physical senses. So it is always bound up with the physical world. We can't know anything prior to the physical world. What we can know is that whatever God is now in terms of his perfection, now again in our own framework, our own time framework, those perfections were not lost at all prior to creation, because God does not change. That's a statement in Malachi. That's one of the prophets, the last of the prophets, and he says openly that I am God, I do not change. That is his prophetic word to the Jewish people. God is telling him, you say this to the Jewish people, let them know, I am God, I do not change. Ani Hashem lo shinisi. I am God, I do not change. It means to say that God, who is perfect, is not affected by anything. And there is no change. Change is something which is part of the behavior of the physical world. So therefore, there are certain truths that were always true, even before the creation. Now, those are the fundamentals that Maimonides is talking about. Then there are pillars of wisdom. Wisdom is now the sciences of how the world operates. Chemistry, biology, thermodynamics, physics, all these areas of science, again, rely on the knowledge of God in order to have their real pillar. Meaning you can't have, and we'll have to explain this. This is the point where we left off on yesterday. But we have to understand why it is that without knowledge of God, a chemist or a physicist will not have true knowledge. I mean, the question we ask is, what's the difference between myself and somebody else? We both studied the same exact books for the same number of years. We get tested and we can repeat the exact same knowledge. However, if I have knowledge of God, I really have knowledge of physics. Whereas if he doesn't have knowledge of God, he doesn't have knowledge of physics. That's the question I'm going to pose to you now that I want you to think about. Just type in a quick okay if you have that question. I'll repeat it. What is the difference? Because Maimonides again is saying that the fundamental of all fundamentals is to know that God exists, and the pillar of all sciences, of all knowledge, is to know that God exists. So we're asking, so why is it so essential? Why can't I study a science without knowledge of God and still have the same knowledge as somebody else? What am I lacking? What am I lacking regarding my knowledge of that given science if I do not know God exists? And what is the other person gaining if he does know that God exists? Okay. And if somebody could just do a favor, I see a couple of people can't get the sound for whatever reason. If somebody, actually, let me ask one person to do this. Al in New York, since I see you as the last entry, just type on the screen, please, address Yaakov and also Esther. Let them know that they can go to the audio files to hear this class. After the class is over. So we do record all the classes. So if you just want to make a note, I appreciate that. Okay, so everybody has a question. Good. All right, again, the question is, thank you, Al. The question is as follows. Maimonides is making a very, very bold statement, which requires us to understand it. He, first of all, distinguishes between two areas. There are fundamentals. That has to do with just knowledge of God, regardless of the existence of the world. There are certain things which are true. God is just. Again, our knowledge about this is only after we're here. But these things have to be true even before he created the world, because God doesn't change. But those are what he refers to at Yesod HaYesodos. The fundamental of all fundamentals is this conviction that God exists. And the pillar of all wisdom, meaning without the knowledge of God existing, so you don't have a pillar for your wisdom, meaning wisdom will fall to the ground and crash. So we have to understand now, what are we lacking? So I want you to think about the question, what are we lacking if we study the same science as somebody else, but we don't have knowledge of God, and they do? What is missing from our knowledge? We study the same books, we study the same number of years. What are we lacking in our knowledge of that science without knowledge of God? That's the question. Okay, so let's just pause a bit and let everybody think about the question. Okay, Al, thank you for putting the note up there. Just let her know that you can go to the audio files, put that in quote, audio files link. It's the seventh link down on the links on the left of the screen. So once we finish the class, it'll be put up there within a half an hour. And she'll be able to listen to it with Real Player, I believe, or Windows Media. Okay. All right, so let's think about the question. Okay, Al, thank you. Okay, and if you have a possibility, hold off on typing it for right now. I see your entry, Naomi, but let's just hold off. Let's have everybody have a chance to think about the problem. Okay, if you have possibilities, okay, why don't you type it in now? If you have a possibility, I see a few. Let me just wait and see if anybody else wants to type a possible answer. Okay, so I just see a few answers. Let's see if anybody else. All right, Gene is writing, without knowledge of God, we would see science as independent works. Okay, but wouldn't I still have knowledge of the science, Gene? Naomi wants the question again. Okay, what we're asking is, what is the difference? Why is Maimonides stating that the pillar of all sciences, the pillar of all knowledge, is to have knowledge of God? If you're lacking knowledge of God, then you do not have true knowledge of that science. The question is why? Okay, it's true, nothing would exist if it wasn't for God, Len, but that's not explaining why we wouldn't have accurate knowledge of that science. We want to understand why would I have inaccurate knowledge of that science if I do not know about God? Joel is writing, ontology offers no meaning or purpose. All secular science can offer without God is the how, but never the why. This is recognized by scientists. Okay, very good. Very good, Joel. Okay. Now let's just expand a little bit. There are a number of ideas that I want to take on the point that you just mentioned. One reason is because if a person does not have knowledge of God, now he doesn't understand then that these sciences, for example, zoology, a study of animals. So if you look at the animals as something which, let's say, like Aristotle would say the earth always existed. I don't know if he says that about animals, but he says the earth does. So let's say we look at the earth as always existing and not being a creation, meaning it's not something which came into existence, but it always existed. Therefore, he's lacking the true nature, because existence is the most essential component of anything we see. Although we don't see existence, what we see is a person, or we see an animal, or a rock. But these things we know have existence. Existence is something which these things have. That is a very real thing. It's almost like similar like weight. We don't see the weight in something, but we know it has weight. Okay? So also, existence. We don't see, you know, existence in its raw form, because it's something which is part of another being. So if a person does not know the essence of a thing, meaning the essence of something, of anything we see, is its existence. That is the most primary element that it needs to exist. Now, if you have an error about the very existence of a thing, now you have an error about the thing essentially. You are lacking knowledge, essential knowledge about the object that you are studying, you do not have. The essential knowledge about this object is its existence. How did it come into existence? Without knowing that it was created by a creator, you are lacking the most essential of all knowledge of that thing. That's the first answer. There's many answers. Okay, that's just the first point. Since the true nature, the most primary substratum of anything that we see is its existence, if we make an error about its existence, then we've made an error about the thing essentially. If I make an error about the rock, I say it's dark brown instead of black. It's really a black rock. It's coal, for example, but I call it dark brown. So I've made a mistake about the object, but it's not an essential mistake. It's an accidental mistake, because I'm making an error about its accidents. Color is an accident of the object. If I say that this diamond is 1 carat and it's really only 9.9 carats, yes, I made an error. However, it's not an error essentially. If I say this diamond always existed for all time, now I've made an error that has to do with the essence of this thing. I don't think that this was a created thing. And by making that mistake, a person loses out on now reflecting as to why God made this, like the one of you had written. Okay, let me just take a look quick on screen. Okay, D. Sands in Florida, science involves natural laws, but God created these laws. Correct. Zadie, he's agreeing with Gene, okay. Lennon, Vermont, nothing exists if it wasn't for God. True. Joel is writing, ontology offers no purpose. Okay, good, we addressed that. All right, Joel was the one who said we would be missing the why. Okay, Gene is writing, yes, knowledge, but not the purpose of their existence. Yaakov, okay, still having a problem with the speakers. Gene is writing how it reflects God's wisdom. Correct, meaning it's a reflection of God's wisdom. And that we're going to get to as the final answer, which I think is very important, Gene. Davide, because this message was given to the Jewish people from Moses and all future generations, does this assume that all future generations must accept on faith? No, they must prove it. That's why Maimonides writes here, you must know that God exists. Okay, Davide, we don't work by faith in terms of knowledge of God. In terms of that God will be consistent and he'll be just throughout generations, yes, we have faith about that. We see the way he's behaved, if we could use the term behaved, but the way he's acted towards mankind in the past. And we know that he is consistent, that he doesn't change. So we know there you could say a person will have faith that I'll live the right life and God will help me out. That you could say. But you don't say, I have faith that God exists. That's something which Maimonides says we can prove, and everybody should prove it to themselves. Okay. So that's one idea in terms of why, if we don't have a knowledge of God, then we're missing the whole knowledge of what we're studying. The whole essence of this thing is that it was created without knowledge that it was created. So we're missing the essential knowledge about this thing. You're making the biggest error possible. Okay. Another thing which we're missing is, like I think Gene just mentioned, that the purpose of existence and reflecting God's wisdom. Yes, that was Gene. And also Naomi. That we miss out on the fact that this is, if we don't assume God exists, then something existed always, or it just happened by evolution, and but God's not part of the equation. So then we miss out on the fact that this does not afford us a reflection of God's wisdom. And this is a very important point. This is something I grappled with a little bit yesterday, because it seems to be that everything we're going to look at will always call back to the fact that it was created by God. So is that giving me the same piece of information over and over again, that God created this and that and this and that? It's like repetitious. Do I really need it? The answer is, though, that it's not repetitious. Because everything we see, and we see how it functions, it gives us another facet of knowledge about God. It's not superfluous. So when we see an animal kingdom, and then we see how they function, and then we have a certain knowledge of God's justice, of how he works with animals, but then we see how he works with man, there's a new area. And then we study the universe and the cosmos, it's another area of how brilliant the whole system is, that with so many billions of galaxies, and they could be so huge and so far spread across the heavens. Everything we look at, when we realize that it's created, it now gives a reflection that increases our knowledge and our appreciation for God. So there is so much in the world, because there is so far that we can go. We do have a limited lifespan. But you can look at Adam and his generation, they lived for 1,000 years, and they didn't scratch the surface of God's knowledge. It's impossible for man to have God's knowledge. Only God has God's knowledge. But there is so much to uncover, and as we uncover more and more, it gives us more of an appreciation for God's wisdom. That's why he created the universe and everything that's in it, and all these precise laws and pleasant designs and things that taste good, and the way he created man and his body and all the functions and the digestive system and the circulatory system. And we understand so much, and we start appreciating more and more. So all of our knowledge has to culminate in a greater appreciation for the Creator. That is our goal. That's why it's essential to every single science that we know that God exists. Otherwise, we never come back to a greater love. That is the primary reason why Maimonides is saying, without knowledge of God, you do not have your science. Knowledge and conviction of God's existence is the most essential ingredient for all sciences. And without it, you don't have true knowledge of that science. Okay, let me just take a look on the screen now, see if there's any questions or comments. Okay, and Naomi's writing, we missed a meeting. Actually, the screen just jumped. Where is that? We missed the purpose of science, right? Okay, Davide, every generation has not personally experienced the fire event at Sinai. So how then do we know absolutely that he exists without faith in Moses' words? Well, we gave the proof before, because the story would not have reached us today if it was false. Like any, you have to ask that on any point in history, Davide. Any historical account you have today, any country, I don't care what it is, something which is unanimously accepted as a true history, why do we say it's true? Because there were masses at the event, and what they perceived was apprehensible by the normal human mind. And that's why it traveled through history, and we have it today. The story would not have traveled and passed down unanimously if it was not true. That's our proof. It's not faith. Joel is writing that goodness is not God's essential characteristic. That is power. Fortunately for us, he is also good. No, goodness is a characteristic of God. And again, when we talk about God's characteristics, we can't start separating out. But God's goodness is he created the world out of his goodness. I don't know what you mean there, Joel. Okay. Let's see. Okay. DSANS is saying, example, tsunamis are not just. Can you explain this? Well, they are just. The fact that there is heat in the earth and that there are plates at the ocean floor, this is all part of God's design. Now, if a person is completely righteous, God would have stepped in and made sure that that person was not hurt by the tsunamis. All right? But like King David says, that people who don't have God and have their incorrect notion of God, they're like animals, meaning there's no specific divine providence for them. So you can have events like this where 23,000 people, I think the number is up to now, are wiped out. But if a person has merit, you see from history, we have proven examples where God saved the Jews from Egypt with 10 miraculous plagues. Okay, again, in terms of God's strict system of justice, a person who perfects himself, he'll have individual providence. If a person doesn't, then he lives like an animal, so he's treated like an animal. Okay. Joel is asking, has this been lost in modern science? This was a starting point for Einstein. Could something like string theory be the result of science removed from some essential a priori assumption? I'm not sure what that science is. We'll have to talk about it at a different point, or you could write it on the screen if you want. Okay. If somebody wants to type on screen, it looks like Esther is really frustrated about not being able to get to the class. We're going to try to see what we can do. We try to post the Windows Media Player on the entry page to the live classes. Evidently, that's not working for her. So we will look into it further, but she can listen to the classes on a PC with, in the audio files page, because we are recording all the classes, so she will not be missing out. But we will try to see if we can get this working for as many browsers and operating systems as possible. Maybe, Al, you want to type that in again? You'll be my representative over here. Okay, DeSantis in Florida asks again, so only unjust people are killed by acts of nature? Maimonides has a whole treatise on this in his Guide for the Perplexed. We actually have the entire Guide for the Perplexed in English on our site, thanks to the scanning of some other people. They made it available on the web, so you can look that up, or you can buy the book. But yes, the Torah goes in at great length and detail, describing how, inasmuch as a person is greatly perfected, so then he has more providence from God, even to the point that God will make a miracle, and he'll save Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. These three men were thrown into a fiery furnace, and they didn't even get singed by the fire. And there was not even the smell of smoke in them. And that's in the book Daniel. So if you read the book Daniel, it's in the second chapter. Joel's writing that modern quantum mechanics seems to support a steady-state universe needing not creator. Well, what created the modern quantum mechanics theory? Something had to create that law. So you get back to square one. What made these governing laws of the universe? There had to be something which made those laws. They didn't always exist. Okay. Jer in Connecticut is asking, I know this is a hackneyed question, but how does one counter the notion of the argument based on evil, meaning God is all-knowing and all-powerful, yet there is tragic events in the world that God either could not stop rendering him, could not stop, which would render him not all-powerful, or he does not know, or so he isn't all-knowing. Well, there's another possibility. The God is all-powerful, and he is all-knowing, yet there's a system by which he's trying to teach man to live. And there are certain laws of nature that are essential for the entire existence of the universe. I mean, you have rain, and you have, I'll give you an example. You have rain because it's necessary for everything that has life and needs water. You also have mountains. You need to have mountains because without mountains and valleys, rivers cannot flow to far reaches of the earth where there are inhabited areas. And those people would also not have rain. Let's say it's a certain region that doesn't get rain, like Egypt. So without the Nile, and the Nile only exists because you have a valley between two higher elevated parcels of land. That's what creates a valley, and that's what allows the river to run. Now, without high and lows, without different elevations in the Earth's topography, And without water, you wouldn't have life. All of you agree, correct? But at the same time, you're going to have rain that's going to hit a mountain at a certain point, creating a mudslide, and certain people might be killed. Again, if these people are 100% righteous, God is not going to kill them. That is something which you will learn. You will see these are the words of King David and the entire Torah. And only a person who is deserving of punishment or a person who is just not under God's providence will he be subject to the laws of nature. But in terms of the life of the entire planet, you need to have mountains. You need to have water. You need to have rain. So there will be something called mudslides. That phenomenon is going to exist by definition. But that's for the greater good of the entire world. And that's God's justice. So it's a matter for us not to look at every single person and say, every single person requires the same level of justice. Well, who here has really studied God's justice to that point that you can say that? All right? It's a haughty thing to say without studying. Okay. Let's just pause for a second. If everybody has these ideas we're talking about, let's just type an okay on screen, get some feedback from you that we're all off the par, we're all on the same page. No problem, Joel. No problem. No apology needed. Okay, if everything's clear up to this point, please type an OK on your screen. Okay, Al, thank you for putting the message in there. I appreciate that. Looks like Esther is happy about that. Okay, at DSANS in Florida, the download, if you do a search on our site, Guide for the Perplexed, we'll put in the word perplexed. You'll see where it comes up. There'll be one of the result page. One of the results will be Maimonides' Guide for the Perplexed. And then you can go through and search. You could do a Control F once that page opens up, and you'll be able to type in whatever word you want, and then it'll jump to that word on your screen. Okay. And let me just see what Joel's writing again. I agree, but what quantum mechanics postulates is that the laws of this universe are only necessary to this universe, but by no means absolute. It is simply the nature of this particular system. Okay, so we're in agreement. We're in agreement, Joel. Len VT is writing no. I'm not sure what you're writing no about. Okay, Davide, very good, touche. You like the fact that we're talking metaphors as a means of explaining metaphors, okay? If it does the job, they're very useful, and every single rabbi has used them. Because the reason why we use metaphors is because it calls on what we're familiar with in order to bring us to a new level of knowledge. That's what the whole reason why a metaphor is used. It allows a person to take from his current knowledge base, which he's comfortable and familiar with, and he can transpose certain relationships onto new areas. That is how metaphors work, and that's why they're used. All right, getting back to why knowledge of God is essential for all sciences, there's more reasons. Okay, like we were saying, one of the primary reasons is that if one lacks knowledge of God's existence, so then all earthly creation is not going to serve as a vehicle for man to approach the love of God. Again, God created the universe as an act of kindness and then put man on the universe as the last thing he created, which demonstrates that the stage was set and then man was put onto a ready set table like the rabbis use for another metaphor. In order to show you that God created the entire earth for man's use, to study and to come to an appreciation for God, that's why God put his wisdom into everything that he created. And the more we unravel it, the more wisdom we can get. Okay, Len, thank you. Joel is writing, we use metaphor because we cannot speak in any other way. We can only say this thing is like that thing. Okay, good. Correct. Okay. So it's important to understand now that this very knowledge of God is going to allow it, and in all areas of creation. It's not just a redundant thing that, oh, this was made by God, that was made by God. No, if we study everything that we come across and we ponder it, whatever it is, it could be how air operates, water, science, the words of the prophets, Moses' discussions. We study all these areas that God desires that we have. Each time we arrive at a new question and then the new answer, we gain a greater appreciation. And if we proceed in this manner throughout our lives, we will grow on the right path. And it's not a race. We can only, you know, there's only so many hours in the day. We definitely should maximize our hours in learning and minimize our hours at work. We should only be working for what's necessary for our existence. We're not taking anything to the grave. So it's foolish for a person to try to hoard away millions and to put more time into work than what's necessary. And the way of the rabbis is that they said, minimize your work and maximize your learning. That's really what we should be doing. So that's why it's so important, and it's nice to see that so many of you could take the time off in the middle of the day. I'm sure many of you are at work, but yet you're putting the time in to learn. And again, please make use of the entire site, and the resources that we have here are free, and they're for you to really gain and ask questions and interact with us. And this, again, the actual classes, we hope are going to be something that you really gain quite a bit from, so this way you can ask your questions in real time. Okay. D-Sans, you're asking, is illness also considered to be caused by a godless life? Well, a person could bring out his own illness, or a person could be stricken with illness by God. All right, so there's different ways. A person has to be careful with his life. Okay. Now, okay, so I think that sums up the point in terms of why Maimonides says that this is the pillar, meaning knowledge of God is the pillar. Why is it a pillar? We also said an interesting point yesterday on the word pillar. Again, Maimonides' words are very exact. A pillar to something, for example, if you put a trophy on a pedestal, so the pedestal is one thing, and the pillar and the trophy is another thing. So what's that an analogy to? The trophy is the science. And the pedestal that you put it on is knowledge of God. So that science is resting. It needs to have knowledge of God as its foundation. But that knowledge of God is something which is is external to the science in that it's supporting it. In that sense, it's supporting it. All right. Okay, so we went a little bit further. And we went on to the next law, where Maimonides says, and I'll read to you his words. And if you would bring it upon your heart or your knowledge that God wouldn't exist, then nothing else would exist. Nothing else would be possible to exist. And this goes back to the point. He's now illustrating. Maimonides is doing is he sets you down the rule, but then he illustrates what he's saying. Meaning God's existence is essential to everything else. Nothing else exists by itself. Everything we see, ourselves included, our existence from day to day is only because God constantly wills that we exist. We don't exist just automatically. It's not that God created something and now, boom, it's going to go on forever. No, it requires that constant sustenance on a regular, daily, momentary basis. Without God's will constantly, as the rabbis say, flowing down to all of creation, everything would cease to exist. It's only through his will that it exists. So if God, if you could somehow think that God wouldn't exist, which is impossible, but if you could somehow think that, then everything else would vanish. Everything else would cease to exist because things don't exist by themselves. And the converse is true. In his next law, we're in the fundamentals of the Torah, chapter 1, law number 3. And he reads as follows. V'im yale al adas. And if you'll bring it up upon your knowledge that none of the existences that we see would continue except for God, meaning if we could imagine the entire universe just vanishing except for God, right, he would continue to exist. And he would not be nullified because of the extinction of everything else. Because all of the existences that we see need him, and he, blessed be he, does not need them and not any one of them. I want to repeat this last thing. And he, blessed be he, again, if we would think that everything would stop existing except for God, God would not be affected because everything gets extinguished. Why? because all of creation, everything we see, needs him. But he, blessed be he, does not need them. God needs nothing from creation. And not a single one. Okay. We now come to our next question. I'm going to repeat it one more time, so listen carefully. And he, blessed be he, does not need them and not a single one. What's questionable about that statement? Right? Maimonides says, again, that if everything would stop existing except for God, God would not be nullified or affected at all by it, because everything needs God, and he does not, and he, blessed be he, does not need anything in creation, and not a single one of them. What's strange about that statement? Okay, so let's stick to the topic over here. I know there's a lot of questions about God's justice and so on, and that's we'll hopefully get on to your other questions. We'll take that at the end of the class. But I just want to take up this last statement of Maimonides. So again, I'm going to repeat it one more time, and I want you to just stop for a second, hold off on the typing, think about what Maimonides is saying and what sounds strange about it. He says that, but God would not be nullified by anything, even if everything stops, you know, ceases, even if everything ceases to exist, he would not be affected by it, and not by a single one. Right? He would not be affected by the extinction of the entire universe at all, because he does not, he, blessed be he, does not need them, and not a single one. What is strange about that statement? Okay, I want you to think about that. If you have an answer, type it into the window. Let's just stay on this one topic here, and then we'll take your other questions afterwards. Okay, just type an okay on your screen if you have the question that I just put forth to you. Let me just make sure that I get down and just confirm the sound is still going well. It should be no problem. You know, once you have the sound, it should just continue. But it also it'll confirm that you have the question. If you all have the question, just type an okay on your screen. All right, thank you, Joseph. Davide, David, Tennessee, thank you. Again, the question, what is strange about the statement that he, blessed be he, does not need the universe at all and not a single one? Okay, Naomi is writing, all of Hashem's creations glorify him, but without it, he would still exist. Okay, good. Ruthie, and not a single one. What is the point of the statement? Very good. Very good, Ruthie. Good, I'm glad you picked up on that. It sounds redundant. If you already said that God, blessed be he, doesn't need them, and not a single one, well, he already said he does not need them. What is he saying he doesn't need a single one? That sounds redundant. All right? That's right, Naomi. Hashem needs nothing to exist. And the proof is that he existed before he created everything. So God requires nothing. Okay, so what does it mean that he doesn't need them, meaning the entire universe, all of creation, he does not need them, and not a single one? What is he adding by saying, and not a single one? All right, Benoach, when you're writing that because it implies that he does not create the universe for his benefit, then what is it for? It's for us. He created it for man to learn, to appreciate his wisdom. God created man as an act of great generosity and allowed other existences to perceive his knowledge and to enjoy that knowledge. That's a great thing. Joel is writing, the whole question is the whole question of the absolute completeness of God seems to beg the question of why the creation in the first place. I know this is a hard one, but there must be a reason for the universe, certainly in the mind of the Creator. Was he simply bored? Of course, we do not affect his existence or nature, for he is the source. But he must be invested somehow in the creation. No, that's not true, Joel. You're projecting human emotion onto God, that he must be he must have a vested interest, quote-unquote, or bored, quote-unquote. These are all emotions that are created emotions. Prior to human beings, there was no such concept of bored. All right? Why God creates the universe, we don't know. And again, that implies motive. Motive, again, is an animalistic behavior. Now, before God created animals and humans, there was no such concept as motive. So we can't know why. All we could say, like Maimonides says, that's his will, right? That's going into the area of what we can't know. Like he told Moses, man can't know God while he's alive. Okay. So what is this concept of Maimonides over here? That he says that God does not need the universe and not a single one, meaning not a single one of the things he created. Why does he have to repeat himself and say, and not a single one? What does he add by saying? I want you all to think about the question now. No, Joel, he's not. This concept of having a vested interest or invested in the universe, no. God gains nothing and loses nothing in the creation of the universe. Again, trying to understand why he did it is not something we can achieve. I'll give you an analogy, since some of you really like these analogies. Those of you who made the joke before. If you can't understand what another person is thinking right now, and that's one human to another human, certainly you can't understand God's thoughts. So we have to accept that our knowledge goes to a certain point. We're not going to know why. In this life, we're not going to know why. But that's all right, because there's plenty that we can know. Right, Joseph is writing, so if man can't know God while man is alive, must we be somewhere else? Well, it might imply that after... it definitely does imply that after death, does man really have a greater knowledge? Okay. All right, he needs nothing. God needs nothing. Naomi, no individual, no Jews, nothing. God does not have needs. Needs is a human emotion. It's a created emotion. God does not possess what he creates. He's not controlled by the very laws of need. He created the laws of need. Joel is writing, can we not trust his selected metaphor? Why did he not wish Nineveh to be destroyed, even though Jonah would rather have stayed home? He wanted people to have the best, so he wanted people to be rebuked about the evil and repent so they can live. Otherwise, they would perish. God making us in his own image does not mean we resemble God in a physical sense. It means that we partake of wisdom. And that's something which God has. So when he made us in his own image and nothing else, it means he gave us intelligence. That's what that means, in his own image. B'tselem Elokim, meaning that we possess something that nothing else has. This is for Davide in San Francisco. And D. Sands, you're writing, if he has no needs, why then are Jews the chosen people, and who determined this? God determined that the Jews are the chosen people, but we're chosen for a mission, that we should be teaching, and we should be learning the Torah and teaching it to the entire world. The Torah is not just for the Jew. The Torah is for every single man. But every other nation only has to perform a minimum of 7 commands. But the Jew has to perform all 613. Although it'll be impossible for any one Jew to do all 613. Some apply to priests, some don't apply to women, so on and so forth. All right, some don't apply unless you're in certain situations. If you never buy a home, if you never live in a house, you don't have to fulfill mezuzah. Things of that nature. Okay? So when God selects the people, the Jews, to be chosen, it's not because he needs us. He's doing it for the rest of mankind and for us. It's for our own benefit. The tov lach. You should study the Torah, Moses says to the Jews, for your own good. So you have to realize, it has to be clear that if God created something, he's not controlled by it. He created the whole institution of human need. So before he created human need, there was no such thing as need. He's not controlled by what he creates. He's nothing, and again, Yeshaya, Isaiah says openly, he says, quoting God, to what shall you equate me that I should be similar in any way? God is saying there's nothing in your life experience that you can make an analog to me, to God. So anything we see, perceive, hear, touch, smell, taste, experience, anything that we come in contact with in life, and in no way is it similar to God. And God does not need Jews to spread his commandments, DeSantis in Florida. He does it for us. He does it for other people. He does not have needs. Okay, I think that's clear enough. Joseph is asking, I have a question about the grafted in Goyim. Okay, let's not go to the side questions. We have a question right now on the table. Let's take that. All right, there's a million questions. We can go on all day about the questions, but the purpose of the class was to understand Maimonides' words over here. Now, what does it mean again that God does not need anything in creation and not a single one? I believe the answer is that he's trying to show you that when he says not a single one, he doesn't need anything in creation and not a single one, to show you that he is absolutely independent. When he says that he does not need anything in creation, but then he says not even a single thing, that now underlines and crystallizes the concept he is delivering here, and that is that God is completely independent. He does not depend on anything. By definition, he can't. That's part of his very definition, is that he is the first cause. So nothing is necessary for him. That's why Maimonides is saying over here. But he also said another thing which nobody picked up on. No problem, Joseph. There's also another thing that nobody picked up on. He says, but he, blessed be he, does not need anything in the universe, and not a single one. Why is Maimonides throwing in the words, blessed be he? He doesn't do that anywhere else over here. All of a sudden, he throws in the term, and he, quote-unquote, blessed be he, does not need anything in the universe, and not a single one. All right, so we understand now a very good piece of information. When he says that he doesn't need a single one, it removes everything from having any type of relationship to God in terms of having any effect on God. By saying that he doesn't need a single one of the things that he created shows you that he's completely independent. You must have that idea clear. All right. But now, one last question, and then we'll open up the floor to your other questions from before. One last question is, what does it mean? Why is he using the term, and he, blessed be he? That sounds like an odd term. That's not necessary. Why do you have to bless God in the middle of stating a law about God's nature? What's the need to say he, blessed be he? All right, if you have the question, just type an OK on your screen. Let me just have confirmation that you hear the question. Joel, what you're writing over here is a very dangerous idea. You're writing, it could also mean that although he is without form, one second, let me just go back. Just lost the page. Okay. You're writing that, it could also mean that though he is without form, that if he were to take a shape, he would look very much like us. Okay, that's Christianity, and that is impossible. that you have to just strike that from being a possibility in your mind that God's going to take form. It's impossible. God is not controlled by anything that he creates, meaning physical form is a law. And he will not ever have physical form. So it's impossible to even think that he would take form, let alone that if he would, it would look like a person. And you write further, could it be that we are a complete object and he is erratic? Again, this is all based on a wrong notion. That's a wrong idea. Again, like I quoted in Isaiah, God says, I am not like anything that you can equate me to it. So that's it. That answers the question. God is not similar to anything. He can never be physical. Right, that is one of the biggest errors of Christianity. All right, and again, Naomi, he does not need Israel, the Goyim, individual souls. God does not have needs. That must be clear. Okay, Joseph, thanks. Davide, good. Jean, David in Tennessee. Ruthie in New York. Nancy in Massachusetts. Rob in Boca. Okay. Everybody else have it clear? But I think what Maimonides is getting at is like this. When he says that he, blessed be he, does not have a need, what does he mean, blessed be he? He's trying to emphasize that he is above all. When he says that he, blessed be he, does not need anything in the universe, he's trying to express this idea that he is totally above and elevated over all existences. And he should be blessed, meaning it's something that should be our response. Our response should be, God is amazing. You know, and what he has done in creating is just an amazing feat that we is unmatched by anything that we know, and that he should be praised because of this. Just like you would praise someone who does a fantastic thing in science that helps so many people. Certainly, God should be praised for what he's done. He created science. He created the physical from nothing. Okay. All right. Jerry in Connecticut. Now we're going to just take some side questions. Okay, Jerry in Connecticut writes, but God did take some form when he showed Moshe his back. That's a metaphor. Jerry, you have to look at the commentators. You know, the Torah is given with an oral law too. So just reading the Torah verbatim in the written form without the oral, you only have half the picture, and sometimes a corrupt picture. So that is a metaphor again. When he showed Moses his back. What does that mean? You have to study that area. Take a look at Rashi. Rachel in Florida is writing, my non-Jewish friends always challenge me with, quote, yeah, but God can do anything, even make himself physical if he wanted, end quote. Well, Rachel, my response to them would be, yes, God can do what he wishes, but God is limited. God cannot do everything. Now, that may astound you. What do you mean God can't do everything? I'll give you a very simple example. God cannot punish somebody who's 100% without sin. He cannot do it. And don't think that that limitation now minimizes God in your eyes. Because, again, using an analogy, what if I told you I knew a judge? And again, I'm directing this, Rachel in Florida. This is for you. And everybody else, this is a very important point. Because what Rachel is saying is something I've heard many times. Many people say, well, God can do anything. He could even make himself physical if he wanted, and so on and so forth. Well, he can't do the impossible, all right? And that is part of his perfection. That's not a detraction. An analogy would be if I told you about a judge who cannot make a wrong determination. He always finds the guilty person guilty, and he always finds the innocent person innocent. Let's say I can produce a person like this. Wouldn't you say that that limitation, the fact that he can't make an error, isn't that a positive? Even though he's limited, but that's a good thing. So just because there is limitation does not mean that it detracts from the perfection. Something which is perfect is limited to being perfect. By definition, if you say that God is perfect, that means he's limited to being perfect, and he's not imperfect. According to your friends, Rachel, they would have to say, yeah, if God wants, he could make mistakes too. That's a foolish statement. Similarly, God cannot make something square and round simultaneously. All right, there are certain things that are impossible. God does not do the impossible. That has to be clear. Rachel, I want you to write me back that you hear what I'm saying. Again, God is not going to punish anybody who doesn't deserve it. Now you might say, well, that means God can't do everything. The answer is yes, God cannot do everything. Because we grow up And we're taught with foolish, infantile notions about God being some sort of a superman, that he can do everything. But that's not true. You have to follow reason. We have to mature our understanding of God as we get older. As we mature physically, we have to mature in the more primary area of our life, our thoughts, our ideas. Okay. So it is true that God is limited to being perfect. He's limited to being absolutely just. He is limited to what is possible. But there are things that are impossible. It's impossible for white to be black at the same time. That's an impossibility. So not only does God not do the impossible, but God will not. And he cannot do something which is not just. God cannot do something which would be hurting somebody who doesn't deserve it. And then you'll have to study all the cases to see why God did something at a certain time to this person and not to that person. You'll find distinction in all the cases. Okay, Rachel, I assume that means you have the answer. Okay, good. Let me see other questions here. But even a stop clock is right twice a day, okay? Joel is writing, I'm not so worried about God not punishing the righteous. What I'm worried about is that he might then be thinking of me. Well, if a person should correctly be worried about any sins that he does, and he should regret them, and he should repent. Because a person who repents and honestly commits himself never to do the sin again because he feels bad about the past, and he accepts on the future that he won't do it, you need both things are necessary for repentance. Regret on what you did, and acceptance that you will not do it again in the future. If you do that, then you could sit in like you didn't sin. If you are completely removed from that sin, then you're not punished for it. Davides in San Fran, what is actually impossible for God? Do you think it to defying laws of physics? No, God can suspend laws of physics. We see that he stopped the sun, that he created he turned water into blood. So he can control the laws that he created. But in terms of doing something which is completely unjust, that is something he will not do. He cannot do. All right. All right. Robin Boker is saying, if God cannot punish someone who is without sin, how do I understand the killing of so many of the greatest Jewish scholars during the Holocaust? Okay, well, you don't personally know these individuals in terms of what they did in their life, whether they were deserving or not. So you can't make a statement like that. All I can tell you is again, what I said earlier, look at the Torah. The Torah is supposed to be a guidebook for God and also in terms of his justice. And you'll see when he stepped in and saved certain people and when he didn't. And he even made miracles for people that were deserving. So God's hands are not tied. There is a concept that when the destroyer is let loose, he doesn't distinguish between the good and bad. We'll have to look into that. That is something which I agree we have to look into. But again, I'm sure we will arrive at a very rational and pleasing answer. Okay, Davide, if you say God will not do anything unjust, how do you explain bad things happening to good people? Well, again, Davide, take a look at Maimonides' Guide for the Perplexed. He talks about that the most evils that happen in the world are man's self-inflictions. He says many evils is what happens from nature to man, like mudslides, earthquakes. Even more are the evils that man perpetrates against his fellow man, but the majority of evils that man experiences in his life is because of his own ignorance. It's his own self-infliction. Individual cases we could take up, but I'm sure if you analyze it, you'll see that God's system is completely intact. God has not stopped functioning absolutely righteously. Carolyn Fay is asking, well, if God cannot punish the righteous, why did he allow the Holocaust? All right. Again, I think I answered that with the previous, with who was that? That was Robin Boker. Okay, I think they addressed that. Ben Noach is saying the impossible, meaning falsehood, exists only so far as fantasy. Very good, exactly. The fantasy only exists in our minds for that same reason that we can imagine doing evil. We have the capacity to imagine evil and falsehood, so that we may choose between good and evil, truth and falsehood. Okay, I agree. Okay, Al is writing that in the Holocaust there were many who survived. Okay, that's a good response. All right, and God has many ways of meeting out justice, and he can collect people at a certain point, at a certain time, and allow that if they die at this point, they may have certain sins that they're paying for. Also, God punishes the righteous in this world so they can have a completely clear slate in the next world, is what the rabbis say. So a person could have sinned when he was younger, and the Holocaust came, and God decided, that's the point, I'm going to punish you for that one evil you did when you were younger. But again, you have to study the area of God's justice, just like you would study biology, but even more so, because this is more abstract. At least with biology, you can have a subject you can examine under a microscope. But in terms of God's justice, that you have to look at all the events and look at the Torah and not make statements about how can God do this and not do that before you even started studying. And it takes years of study. You have to understand that we are very ignorant at this point and have to learn what we have in the Torah and the prophets and writings in the Talmud. There's years of study we have to put in before we could start making these assumptions that it's unjust for God to do the Holocaust and all. Okay. Okay, Zaidi is writing, but so many bad people were saved in the Holocaust, those who convert, okay? A good point here is not to look for a particular situation that we don't have sure knowledge of, okay, good, but rather to look what God says about his justice in the Torah and look ourselves. Excellent, Joel. Thank you. Okay, it seems like we started on the proof of God and we got into God's justice, but that's fine. Okay, I think I addressed questions now. If there's any question that I did not address, please type it in again. I'm just looking at the whole screen, and I think I addressed what I've seen so far. Rachel is asking, can you say again why God taking a human form is unjust? That's not a matter of unjust. That's a matter of impossible. But God is not controlled by his creation. He designed and created the physical from nothing, so he controls it. It does not now turn and now control his form. God is not controlled. The carpenter is not controlled by the table he makes. God is not controlled by his creations. And by definition, he is not similar to anything in the physical world. The physical world is his creation. Prior to his creating the physical, nothing physical existed. He does not partake of the physical at all. How could you say that he can become physical? I mean, it's a... I know it's going back to your idea that he can do anything, but I'm explaining to you, God cannot do anything. All right? God cannot do everything. He cannot be unjust. He cannot be physical. He cannot become hungry. Now, if you want to tell me that's a problem, well, you have to think about why should that be a problem? Those are all perfections. Again, going back to our example with the judge who can't judge anybody falsely. If you have a judge, and he judges every person who's innocent as innocent, and he judges every person who's guilty as guilty, he never makes a mistake. So that's a limitation. The judge is limited to only finding the right response in every case. He's limited. But there, no judge exists like that. If you did have one, that limitation would be a perfection. So don't equate the words limitation and imperfection. That's not true. A limitation could be a very high perfection. God is limited to acting precisely with justice. Somebody's writing, somebody with no name, would you please discuss the tools necessary to come closer to understanding these abstract concepts of God in a down-to-earth way? Well, that comes from daily study of Torah, learning the five books of Moses, learning the prophets, learning the writings, going through the Talmud. We've spent many years putting together our site here, make use of what we have on the site. We've got close to probably over 1,000 articles that are searchable by keywords, so, and audio files and recorded classes from numerous rabbis. And these, I feel, are the cream of the crop of rabbis. I've heard many people speak, and I've never heard people like these rabbis, and we've posted them online, and so make use of it here. Or the best thing is to really get a person to study with, a real good chacham, a Talmud, a person who studies for years and then study with them. Okay, the rabbis talk about Rob. Rob is asking how come children were killed in the Holocaust. The rabbis talk and they say that... children below 13 do not have merit yet. They're still functioning based on their emotions. Now, God brought them into the world, and God can take them out of the world as a punishment to the parent. So children are killed as punishments to the parents. If that's the right type of punishment for the parent, God will use it. If it's not, God will use another punishment. Okay, to the person with no name, no problem. I hope that you gain a lot from what we're doing here. But these ideas about God are the most important ideas that we can have, because everything else is based on it. When we have a appreciation for knowledge, and when we study the world, and we learn more about the Torah, the appreciation has to be for the right idea of God. So it is so essential, and you should be, and all of you here today, you should do what you can to teach others too. All right, this is something which we're obligated to study, and we're obligated to teach. And once you have an idea clear, you should be teaching it over to as many others as you can. So that's very important. Okay, so this has to be a clear idea. Okay. If there's any other questions, we'll type them in now. Otherwise, we will resume. Today is Monday. We will resume on Wednesday at 1:30. Mark your calendars. I'm not sure we're going to keep on sending out these email blasts because I don't want to, you know, we don't want to, we have a list of people. Some of them come to the class, some don't. We don't want to inundate people with too many emails. So just, you know, make it your business to look at the schedule on the live links page to see if there's any change in time, any change in class. But for now, next class will be 1:30 United States Eastern Time, Wednesday, or the 29th. Okay. Any other questions on what we did or the other points that we took up? Think of what we said too. Discuss it. If you have questions, come back next time and ask the questions. But if you have the idea clear, definitely teach it over to others. Okay, Pat. Pat, NL, what does NL stand for? I'm not sure. New London, Netherlands. Maybe there's another state like North Dakota that starts with an L. You got me there. Zadie is writing, have you tried PowTalk for classes? Again, it has improved there. Well, we did that once in the past, Zadie. We used PowTalk, but that requires people to download. Here it's very simple. You just come and you hear the class right away. All you have to just do is refresh your browser. So I think we'll keep it to this format. They also throw a lot of advertisements at you, and it's distracting. Okay, Gene, my pleasure. Davide, my pleasure. Okay, B21 2BB. I can understand violence like the Holocaust because that is done by men. But what about when innocent people are killed by natural disasters or when a baby suddenly dies from SIDS? That seems, in a way, more unjust than a war and Holocaust. All right, that's a good distinction. The Holocaust was perpetrated by man, but there are certain... for example, a woman who drinks alcohol when she's pregnant is going to affect the baby. The baby did nothing. But there are certain causes and effects. That's how the world works. And diseases also spread. And if people are involved in homosexuality and they get AIDS, and then they have sex with a heterosexual partner, and they get AIDS, well, what did the partner do? Why did the partner get AIDS? But you could see if they were careful and they looked into the person's past, they might have determined, hey, this person had intercourse with other males, and I can get AIDS. So a lot of times ignorance is what causes disease. It can't answer every single case. And natural disasters, we explained, if a person is absolutely righteous and does not deserve to die, God has many ways of saving people. But if people are like living like animals, King David said, then they're treated like animals. If a person does not live and he's just going after his basic physical needs in life, and that's all he does, and he's not involved in studying God's wisdom, so he's not deserving of God's providence. That's part of the Torah system. Netherlands. Okay, Pat. Okay, Shoshana. All right, Shoshana, the class will be posted online shortly. Okay, Nancy in Massachusetts, my friend. My pleasure. Carla writes, but doesn't the Torah say that children shouldn't be put to death for the sins of the parents? That's correct. Sons are not punished for the sins of the fathers, but that's talking about sons over 13. Then he has his own merit, and if he didn't sin, he doesn't get punished. But, and that's also talking about Beis Din, or I mean, could we talk about God too? I'm not sure actually. But a child under 13, it's God's decision to create him, and he can also destroy him because he has no merits yet. A child under 13 has no merits. Therefore, that you can't say they're deserving of anything at this point. And it's God's will to kill the child to punish the parent. That's God's will. Then we have to study why. That's a good response. Okay, Ben Noach is asking a good question. Why do we presume any victims are righteous? Very good question. That's very good. Okay, Carl is just writing my Peltok, all right. Okay, I'll have to look more into SIDS then. B212BB. Use a name next time so I can, if you want a fictitious name, make up a fictitious name. It's just easier for me to recite it when I read back. All right, if there's no other questions, looks like we'll wrap it up for today. We'll resume Wednesday, 1:30 New York time. And again, please stay posted on that page. Go to the live classes page because we may not continue sending out the emails on a daily basis just in terms of not inundating everybody else. Okay, Ben Noach is writing. I'm not sure what you're writing here. You said, we have no way to truly discern who is righteous, who is Beinoni, and who is wicked. You're right. We have no way to discern. So therefore, we can't say that somebody did or didn't deserve what they got, but we know that God has a system. Ben Noach. Okay, Joseph, my pleasure. Okay, Ben Noach, right. So you're saying, I'm not sure if you're asking it as a question or you're just making a statement. I'm just addressing you, Ben Noach, 31. So if you just want to clarify what you're saying there. Okay, Shoshana. Okay, all the classes are recorded. They're not going anywhere. Okay, so we're going to sign off now. Wish everybody a good day tomorrow as well. And we'll be back on Wednesday at 1:30. Have a good day to everybody.